Welcome to the CGA IGC podcast series, brought to you by CGA's Education Committee and made possible through the generous support of our sponsor, Linsight. Each episode aims to bring you an in-depth discussion related to emerging data, clinical challenges, and unique perspectives in the world of hereditary GI cancers. Before we start, we'd like to remind you that the content of this podcast is not intended to replace professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, and the content reflects expert opinion at the time of recording. Keep listening to find out more about this episode's host, guest, and featured topic. Also, be sure to learn more about our sponsor at linsightlabs.com. That's L-Y-N-S-I-G-H-T labs.com.
Hello, my name is Josh Melson, and I'm a gastroenterologist at the University of Arizona Cancer Center and the CGA Research Committee Chair. The CGA IGC Education and Research Committees are really pleased to present a three-part collaborative research series. So this podcast is going to be the first in that series, and people should stay tuned for subsequent podcasts, which will be coming shortly. I will be your host for this episode, and during today's podcast, I'm going to be speaking with a panel from the Lineage Consortium, and I'm pleased to introduce the following: Swati Patel, a gastroenterologist from the University of Colorado; Zachary Foda, a gastroenterologist from the Johns Hopkins Medical Center; and Holly Lumenskrop from the Division of Cancer Prevention and Control at the Ohio State University. Thanks, everybody, for coming on and talking about the Lineage Consortium. So, Swati, what was the motivation behind developing the Lynch Syndrome Integrative and Genetics Epidemiology Consortium, or Lineage?
It's a great acronym, isn't it, Josh? You know, it's no news to the folks that are probably tuning into this podcast, but Lynch syndrome is the most common hereditary GI cancer syndrome. It affects 1 in 279 individuals in the general population. And for the reasons that our listeners are keenly familiar with, historically, we've grossly underdiagnosed individuals with Lynch, whether it's because folks don't know their family history, or medical providers don't collect or act on that family history, or whether it's because of the atypical and variable penetrance in Lynch syndrome, where there isn't sort of the expected strong family or personal history of cancer. For a long time, the patients we cared for were based on the highest risk families. And that's really where we drew kind of our understanding of long-term outcomes of cancer and Lynch syndrome and our current kind of approach to management. But, you know, as our contemporary practice, particularly here in North America, broadens our ascertainment of Lynch syndrome patients, for example, testing all individuals with certain cancers, like ovarian cancer, pancreatic cancer, moving towards that in colon cancer, more uptake of broad multi-gene panel testing, where we're identifying families that have Lynch syndrome that don't typically look like Lynch syndrome, and then even more kind of disruptive approaches to genetic testing, including population-based testing or even direct-to-consumer testing, we're definitely recognizing in our clinical practices that there's a highly variable phenotype and presentation and penetrance in Lynch syndrome, and that this data that we previously relied upon to understand risk, to understand whether what we do currently for risk reduction works, was probably based on a small subset of all Lynch syndrome patients. So really the rationale behind Lineage was recognizing that there's this critical need to understand long-term risks and risk modifiers in the context of our contemporary ascertainment, and really understand how risk factors affect risk in Lynch syndrome for cancer and how our current practices modify that risk in terms of surveillance strategies. So our goal really with Lineage is to address this scientific gap. With that said, I have personal motivations for having been involved in Lynch syndrome research and specifically the Lineage Consortium. I just get a lot out of working with folks like you, folks like Zach and Holly, and the collaborative relationships that we've built with experts across the continent. Lineage is really designed and intended to be collaborative, inclusive, adaptive, equitable, high quality, transparent, and motivated. These are quotes from our charter, and it's been amazing to build this consortium with friends and colleagues like yourself who share these values.
Thanks, Swati. I mean, there have been other consortiums that have pooled Lynch syndrome data and tried to give us estimates of cancer risk. in specific subcohorts of Lynch, like the prospective Lynch syndrome database or PLSD. What's unique or additive that Lineage is going to bring?
A really good question. We have learned so much from efforts such as the prospective Lynch syndrome database, GeoLynch, the Mismatch Repair Consortium, the Colon Cancer Family Registry, really incredible international efforts at understanding risk in Lynch syndrome. I think with Lineage, the unique feature is a prospective data collection of not just the cancer outcomes of interest, but also detailed risk factor collection, and also really predominantly driven by patients in North America and reflective of our contemporary practice. So I think these are pretty unique features to Lynch, the Lineage database and the Lineage effort. Furthermore, Lineage also includes patient-reported experiences and outcomes. And so in addition to abstraction of structured data from electronic health records and cancer outcomes and colonoscopy data, among other things, we also plan to include a patient-facing survey where we can understand patients' experience, factors that aren't really reliably abstracted from electronic health records, like diet, habits, lifestyle, medication adherence. And the other piece that's unique about Lineage is that we're also organizing at present a digital biobank. So for sites that do have biobanks to really catalog what types of specimens they have on what types of patients and be able to link the biosamples with the clinical data for future discovery. And so we all know that there's a lot of exciting things happening in science regard to Lynch syndrome, whether it's more understanding of pathogenesis of cancer in Lynch, chemo prevention measures, dietary measures, vaccines for risk reduction. So we're hoping that by all speaking the same language, having a data commons, that Lineage can potentially serve as the infrastructure or even a kind of a clinical trials network for cohort identification and future clinical trials, whether they be mechanistic trials or intervention trials, to further the understanding of how to take care of our patients with Lynch syndrome.
Yeah, that's really exciting as building a framework that will have this network that will provide this infrastructure for clinical and potentially mechanistic studies. So Zach, let's step back to kind of really the early planning stages. You know, you have this concept and this goal of moving forward, but you haven't really started the project yet. What are kind of the first steps in developing something like this that's really quite ambitious in starting a consortium? Where do you start?
Yeah, absolutely. And so being part of Lineage from the inception has been a great experience. But I think the first thing is to figure out sort of what the goal is of your consortium and what's the aim and make sure everybody is on the same page for that. And if you can't come up with a clear goal or clear objective for the consortium or clear reason why it would need to be structured the way something like Lineage is structured, then maybe, you know, that's not time to start. And so I think getting people on the same page has been incredibly important for us here at Lineage, you know, talking about shared values and goals, but also shared objectives. And I think any consortium needs to start there rather than working sort of backwards and saying we can create a structure and then come up with a reason for it afterwards.
Holly, when is a consortium the need versus maybe just having some collaborative effort between centers who are working on a project?
Yeah, so consortiums and collaborations both have really great value, and they can both tackle really important research and clinical questions. However, for the sake of Lineage, we chose to create a consortium to be able to aid in addressing some of those really large scale and the prospective nature of those objectives and those aims that we established, while also really keeping sustainability of the project and of the overall consortium in mind. So in using this structure, rather than using a kind of more of a collaborative center structure, it really allows us to better achieve those goals in the long run.
Zach, I noticed that Lineage has this charter, created a charter and spent time really developing a structure of the organization. Why was that needed?
Yeah, I think that was actually one of the very important things to start with, partially because, as Swati laid out in the beginning, we have shared values, shared goals. And these include transparency, representation for everybody involved, equal opportunity to lead and participate in all of the products of the consortium. And we wanted to make that clear up front and make sure that there was nothing ambiguous about it. It's not that we didn't trust each other, or feel like we could do this without things being said, but as a way of keeping things sustainable and saying that this consortium is going to exist only if we follow our values and our goals here, and having that on paper from the beginning rather than sort of appended on the end, it gave everybody something solid to latch onto to say, this is why I want Lineage to succeed. It's because it follows the same values that I have. And so that charter and then the structure as well keeps it that way. And so we did a lot of sort of thinking on what we would need to have in place for this to be sustainable. And I think that's why we are where we are now. I think if trying to pull something together this large with this many people, if we didn't start with the sort of infrastructure, we may have already given up on it, considering some of the challenges we may get to touch on later.
And Zach, I might add that very practically speaking, it's really helpful to have a document that defines who we are, what our goals are, what our values are, and what membership in the consortium will do to improve professional development and advancement, but also care for our patients. And we started as a humble set, few sites that were really interested. And the proverbial, you know, if you build it, they will come. We have increasing centers and investigators who express interest. And the first thing we share with them is this charter so that they can read and review it and understand how this entire process started. And upfront, know whether it's a good fit for them to participate or not. So practically speaking, it's been a very helpful document that served as our North Star, particularly as we've grown so rapidly.
Yeah, I mean, having this kind of organized, goal-directed, collaborative, inclusive effort, I think is really great and inspiring. But Swati, how do you ensure when you're working now with multiple centers and multiple streams of data coming in that the inputs are going to be high quality?
That's so important. I don't know that we can ever ensure anything, but I think from our perspective, it really started well before even getting to the phase of data input or data entry. It's really, really important that every site that signs on has contributed to and agrees on the research aims and the outcomes of interest. When everyone agrees on the science and has the opportunity to be a part of all of the scientific products, whether that's presentations or abstracts, papers, et cetera, that foundation sets the motivation for each site to ensure that data entry is complete and it's accurate. You know, so I think that that's really important. And so we set out to ensure that there was, as Zach said, representation from every site in decision-making, multidisciplinary leadership, where each of us come to taking care of Lynch syndrome patients from our specific expertise and perspectives. And so enlisting content experts as we think about the data that's important to collect that kind of answers our research aims, we enlisted people within the Lineage Consortium with that specific expertise to help. So for example, our current president, Beth Dudley Yurkovich, and her colleague, Eve Karlosky, really helped us formulate the family history form, the genetic testing form to ensure we're collecting the data that's important from a genetics perspective. Matt Yergelin, past president of CGA, Dana Zakulik, committee member, helped us as medical oncologists to ensure that we're collecting all the information that's important and pertinent for Lynch syndrome-associated cancers. Surgical oncologist Bob Hollis, gastroenterologists like Zach and myself, but also Sonia Kupfer, Bryson Katona, Samir Gupta, that all have kind of unique expertise, really played a really significant role in fine-tuning the variables that we collect and the kind of options for how to collect them. Once we had that sort of baseline content validity, ensuring that the database is collecting the data needed to address our scientific questions, we've gone through processes in our database to ensure response process validity, really making sure that the way we collect data optimizes data integrity. So that comes down to some of the nuts and bolts that I find really fun. But for example, radio dials versus select all that apply, trying to make structured fields for almost every possible outcome as opposed to leaving a lot to comment boxes or data enterers not knowing which option is the right option to enter. Internal structure validity to ensure that there's reproducibility and generalizability to our data. So for example, having different people from different backgrounds enter data on the exact same patient and identifying where there's inconsistency so that we optimize how the database is not just structured, but data entry guides. So there's been kind of a lot that's gone towards trying to optimize this goal of high quality data input, but it's been a longstanding effort. I think the key is that every site PI has signed on and believes in this science. And really, they are required as members of the steering committee and members of the consortium to have oversight of data entry on the local level. So for example, for the bigger picture, each site PI, the responsibility would be upon them to ensure that data entered at their site is of high quality, but we provide some guidance on how to accomplish that. For example, for any new data entered, the site PI should audit the first 5 to 10 entries until all errors are reconciled. And then over time, you know, a percentage that the site PI would audit to ensure that data entry is of high quality. But with all of this, the really important collaboration that we've developed is with an entity called Data for the Common Good, who also will be very helpful in doing quality audits of the data. But it's a kind of, I think, ever important goal, not one that will always get perfect in terms of making sure that the data is of high quality. But as we all know, the quality of data in was directly kind of reflective of the quality of the conclusions we can draw from that data. So we take it really, really seriously. You know, we're trying to provide as much concrete guidance to sites as possible to minimize assumptions made at the site of data entry, but always something that's top of mind because we want the science that comes out of Lineage to truly reflect what's happening with our patients.
And thanks, Wadi. I mean, sharing patient data in today's era certainly has challenges when patient-level data is moved between centers. There's some kind of lessons from your experience that you can offer for others who may be working in the collaborative hereditary GI cancer research space in terms of working across collaborative centers and issues that arise in sharing of patient-level data?
For sure. You know, as we've talked about, it's really important to be upfront and transparent about agency over data and how that data will be used. So I think a lot of that is addressed, as Zach outlined, in our governance structure. So each site understands that they own their data and knows exactly how their data will be used. But once even that's agreed upon, you're right. And currently, it's really challenging to navigate various data use agreements, data sharing agreements. I think for folks that are thinking about starting a consortium or a collaborative like this, probably one of the most important initial questions are, what type of data set will answer the scientific questions that you're interested in? The kind of main categories that I think about when it comes to the legalities of data sharing are whether it's a de-identified data set that does not include any patient identifiers, whether it's a limited data set, which might include some patient identifiers, or whether it's a fully identified data set. Because I think knowing which category of data you need to answer the questions that you're interested in will kind of set forth the challenges that you might meet at your local institutions and legal departments about sharing that data. So for example, a completely de-identified data set, there's usually a lot easier to be able to coalesce or combine that data or share it externally. But perhaps there are identifiers that you would need to answer some of the questions that you're interested in. So how do you handle that? For example, dates of diagnosis are considered identifiers. And so do you ask that in some way or shift that, which oftentimes we can do with large data sets to mask those. But there might be things that can't be masked but are still important to your scientific question. For example, zip code, if you want to calculate things like social vulnerability. Those types of things are important to understand what is truly central to the scientific questions you have and what may or may not be deal breakers. But I think thinking about the type of data you have to answer the questions that you need is an important first step. And then, you know, I can just say for Lineage specifically, we engaged with our regulatory bodies and our legal kind of groups on campus early in the process. So as we were developing the protocol, as we were kind of thinking about this collaborative project, we engaged legal departments from various universities to truly get feedback from them as to what they thought was feasible, not feasible, so that we designed the study up front to allow most centers to, at the very least, contribute de-identified data. So There's a lot of challenges around this, but I think most of us are not legal experts. So I think engaging those folks early on in the process, if you're thinking about a collaborative project, will be helpful because we have our blind spots and it's ideal to address those early on.
Yeah, thanks, Swadia. I think that was really helpful thinking about whether the data or the questions that can be answered in de-identified cohorts or whether something more additional would be needed. Zach, when your consortium is starting out, what kind of goals or milestones should be set for in planning, maybe on the short term, but also on the more medium term in the consortium development?
Yeah. And I think it's important to balance the combination of the boring aspects of this. As we've sort of mentioned a few times, there are certain things that need to get done in order for things to be successful and sustainable. Things like dealing with legal departments, things like IRB and consent forms and things like that. Things that are incredibly important, but is probably not what excites the investigators in a consortium, whether they're physicians or scientists or both. But those things need to be done, but you balance that with things that are exciting for people and trying to figure out what are short and medium-term wins you can have, and whether that's an academic product, whether that is increasing the consortium size, or is that partnerships or strategic relationships. For example, we have put together a MOU, or a Memorandum of Understanding with CGA, and that was one of the early things that we did, and I think that kept enthusiasm and excitement for a group. And then also aiming towards startup funds or funds to keep things going while with an eventual goal of funding things on a larger scale. And so I think it's a moving in parallel tracks between the science or the exploration, as well as some of the logistics, and just appreciating that taking one step forward is the overall goal. And in the end, the product that comes out of it is something I think everybody's going to be proud of. And then just also understanding that a lot of this work is going to be voluntary, in that at the beginning of it, your time is something you're going to be volunteering this effort, but you're doing it because you think this is an important thing.
So for the group, I mean, what do you all see as the biggest barriers to success in these types of collaborative research projects?
There are many, Josh, as you all know, but I think this is actually a great time to be engaging in collaborative research. I think if I think about our predecessors, I'm certain that they made efforts towards this where they faced barriers in coming together that we can now overcome very easily with technology. Simply meeting and being able to do so with a large group of people across different time zones was difficult before we were able to hold video conferences or calls. Harmonizing data when people were using local instances of paper records or Excel spreadsheets was very difficult before we had sophisticated data management, data entry programs that are used across different institutions similarly, like REDCap. So I think in some ways, it's a really good time to proceed with efforts like this because a lot of the historical barriers that our predecessors faced, we can now overcome with technology. You know, I think honestly, the biggest barriers on the larger scale from my perspective, and what we spent so much effort and time in up front, was really building a coalition and ensuring that everyone felt represented and included, and that the goals that we came together with were shared goals. And along with that, maintaining engagement and enthusiasm. And I think Lineage is a model in that measure, that we really did spend a lot of time up front bringing as many people to the table as possible and aligning those goals. But it takes time. So, you know, I think the first probably 6 to 8 months were simply coming together and deciding upon our shared goals. But it was, I think, well worth it, because then when the rubber meets the road and we start to develop the details of the data entry, people are on board, you know, and that is a really huge investment for sustainability and longevity of enthusiasm, which, you know, at present, many of us just feel we're doing more and more with less and less time. And so it's really important to motivate people to continue to participate, and investing that time up front to build a coalition, I think, was important. But I think without some of those things, long-term prospective consortia face a lot of challenge if you don't have that.
Okay. Yeah. I've really appreciated hearing about the Lineage strategy and the steps that's been taken for the consortium to get to this point. So Holly or Zach, what can we expect to be coming from Lineage down the pipe here in the short term and maybe even the long term?
I'll say, Josh, I hijacked that last question. I'd love to hear from Zach and Holly's perspective, the challenges that they think collaborative research projects face too.
Maybe I'll just briefly say that in the setting of Lineage here and things, I think I hinted at it before, but this is sort of time you're volunteering. And the reason I think that Lineage has been able to overcome or at least persist in this way is that we do have a sort of group of people at various stages throughout their career, where as an early career investigator, I have a little more protection in my time where I'm able to sort of give that for this. But having, you know, if we are all early in our careers trying to do this, we wouldn't have as many sort of resources as we have and experience. And so I think the voluntary nature of these things, at least at the beginning, is a huge barrier. But I think putting together a team of people from across various backgrounds and various stages of their career has been very helpful.
Yeah. And to follow up on Zach's answer, I think this has kind of been reiterated in several of the responses, but really building a consortium is a huge lift. It requires a lot of activation energy and that sustained enthusiasm that Swati was talking about. And so we have been really fortunate to have a team of very dedicated investigators who see the value of the consortium for researchers, for clinicians, and for their patients, and really want to see it succeed. And I hate to kind of bring this down a little bit, but to succeed long term, we need to be able to get the funding to be able to support not only the infrastructure of the consortium, but also the investigators and the study teams. And so taking then Lineage from this unfunded effort to a funded effort really is a near-term priority of Lineage and the Lineage investigators. And so having that funding will be able to improve our ability to sustain the consortium long-term. And then finally, we also really needed to address the standardization of the data collection, which I think is something luckily we really kind of attacked early. And many of the Lineage investigators have existing local registries while others are initiating their own data collection. And either way, we have to be able to make the data usable across sites. And so it has to be in a common format using those standard data elements. And so as Swati mentioned, we've been fortunate to partner with Data for the Common Good, which really specializes in building those data commons. And so with their assistance, we'll be able to harmonize data coming in from different sources really kind of at the onset of the consortium rather than taking kind of this jumble of things and trying to do it much later. So hopefully then we'll have usable data earlier and be able to kind of produce output a little more quickly.
Yeah, and honestly, Josh, to your question of what do we expect to see from Lineage, you know, I want to shout out Holly and Zach. They actually secured funding to create the patient-facing survey that we mentioned. And so it's not necessarily funding to sustain the consortium long-term, but every little piece that we can break off to get support and funding for is really, really important. But I don't know, Zach, what do you think? What do we see happening with Lineage over the next few years?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely have big goals. And I mean, there's definitely things on the horizon. As Swati mentioned, we've been working on a patient-facing survey that should be going out as part of the first or second line of our data sets. And then I think just thinking bigger, you know, with the digital biobank that we had mentioned earlier, and with the sheer number of patients we expect to sort of be within this consortium, that Lineage can serve as a sort of focal point for potentially even interventional clinical trials or as a biobank for mechanistic trials. And I think we're well within the range of doing that. And so just serving as sort of a spider web or ecosystem for Lynch research within North America, I think that's what's on the horizon for us.
Yeah. And just to follow up on that, I think this is actually really nicely summarizes what both Swati and Zach said, is that I think we can really just expect consortium growth. And so we have over 30 sites who are planning to participate in Lineage in the coming years. And that will really help like strengthen the consortium as well as like broaden its reach and kind of expand its scope. So as a tangible outcome, we're also planning on publishing a methods paper, which will outline the objectives, the structure, and like the data collection tools for Lineage. And we really hope that this paper will then further stimulate interest in participation, as well as introduce the consortium to individuals and sites who really may not be aware of this effort, but want to contribute in the future. So really kind of adding to that broadening of the scope.
Yeah, I think this is such a great contribution to the Lynch field and for those of us that are interested in taking care of our Lynch patients. Maybe looking bigger picture, for those interested in other research questions or other conditions, I know there's no guidebook, but where can others interested in collaborative research get either guidance or mentoring in initiating and planning a collaborative project or a consortium like this?
I'll take that question, Josh. The short answer is CGA. But the reality is CGA has the membership and the resources to really help investigators launch collaborative efforts. There's a dedicated abstract category for collaborative projects alone that can get a lot of kind of attention and promotion at the annual meeting. There's funding opportunities like Zach and Holly have been able to take advantage of. And then all the amazing toolkit of resources that your committee, the research committee, is cultivating and curating for the membership. I think for those interested in collaborative research in hereditary GI syndromes, the answer is simple. Become a CGA member and tap into these resources. When it comes to finding mentorship on how to do these things, I don't know that any one of us is the expert in collaborative consortia. And what we've learned as part of Lineage is we invite members to the team. And as peers, we mentor each other. And I've learned so much from the folks that have worked with us to build Lineage. So, you know, I think there's a lot of opportunity for peer mentorship. And I don't know that there's any single one person that knows exactly how to tackle these issues or do all this, but CGA is like the perfect entry point to connect yourself with both co-investigators and resources.
Okay. Well, really, all of you, Zach, Swati, and Holly, I want to thank all of you for your time in explaining some of the strategies and the efforts and goals, aspirations, and really your collaborative spirit. I think it's really a great motivation, and I wish you all the best of luck, and thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Josh.